May 1st, 2011, 30 minutes after midnight, or zero dark 30. Two Black Hawk helicopters hurtle through the Pakistani sky. They were flying mere feet above the rooftops of the city of Abbottabad to avoid military radar.
This was the result of years of CIA intelligence operations.
Their mission? Kill or capture the man responsible for the deaths of almost 3,000 Americans, Osama bin Laden. For over 10 years, this man had escaped justice, hiding out under the radar. But finally, American special forces were certain they had him cornered.
I don't think the CIA or the military had any idea that how difficult it would be to apprehend this guy.
But if the operation didn't go like clockwork, bin Laden would very likely escape, as he had before.
But when those planes hit on 9/11, we had no one they were going to do that. Not that specific day or that specific target, but that medium of operation, they intended to do that since at least 1995. We spent from December 2001 until May of 2011 looking for it.
The Navy SEAL Team 6 fighters were flying in, prepared to rappel into bin Laden's compound, when disaster struck. The helicopter crash-landed, throwing half the SEAL Team to the ground and attracting unwanted attention. All around, the noise was waking up the people of the city, who were starting to fill the streets. If the SEALs didn't immediately take action, the world's most wanted man would avoid justice once again.
And you know you're fighting against time, and you know that people are going to die.
The town's awake, and so they're thinking, any minute now we can be run down with, you know, a lot of enemy forces coming at us.
They had just minutes to kill Osama bin Laden.
It's rare an op ever goes like it's planned. There's always something that comes up without expecting it.
From Audio Boom and World Media Rights, this is Covert, a podcast about the shadowy world of international espionage and top-secret military operations. I'm Jamie Rennell, and in this episode, we go behind the scenes of the climactic 10-year hunt for the world's most wanted terrorist, and all the careful planning, projection, and personnel that led to this point. We'll go to the very night where Special Ops military forces hunted him down, and how they almost failed. This is The Killing of Osama bin Laden, Part 3. The American military intelligence had spent nearly a decade hunting Osama bin Laden, but to no avail. It seemed the biggest manhunt in history was finally coming to an end. Sources in Pakistan had spotted a man they thought likely to be bin Laden, hiding in a fortress compound near Abbottabad, Pakistan. But there was no way to be absolutely sure. Back on domestic soil, President Obama was facing the most momentous decision of his administration. He needed to choose the best course of action of three main options outlined by Vice Admiral William McRaven, each with detailed branch decisions and what-if scenarios. They could bomb the compound from the air, wait until they could make a positive ID to move, or send in a black ops unit.
The priority was to ensure that you either kill or capture Osama bin Laden, and the only way you could do that was to send in a commando team to do that job.
As the president considered his options, McRaven ordered one U.S. Special Ops team to start preparing. These brave soldiers were the people who were hand-picked for the job and considered the best of the best. The Navy's top-secret counterterrorism force, SEAL Team 6.
But for the most part, the missions, the tactics, what they do, how they do it, it's all close-held secret because you don't want anybody knowing how SEALs operate.
SEAL Team 6 is also known as DEVGRU, the Special Warfare Development Group, and the Navy unit of the Joint Special Operations Command, or JSOC. Don Mann was a commander in SEAL Team 6 and knows well how the team operates.
Because you're out there risking your life for your country, that's the job. And it's not just the fun with the jumping and the diving and the running on the beach and things. The work is risking your life for your country.
Ryan Zinke, now a White House official, also spent some time in the unit.
Well, historically, people didn't talk about SEAL Team 6 because that was, started with counterterrorism. And the mission of that particular team is a little different. The folks that are there are a little older. you have to screen to become a part of SEAL Team 6. There's an additional years of training, of screening.
Only SEAL operatives with years of experience are considered for a job with a team. They can only be men, and they are put through vigorous training to test their limits, both physically and mentally.
I think the thing that separates the SEALs from all others is SEALs just don't quit. They're trained never, ever quit.
They're recalled on a moment's notice, and that's the only team we have that can be recalled and deployed on a moment's notice. So worldwide. And you can't really train all the other teams to quickly deploy to the jungle, quickly deploy to the desert or the Arctic. So you have one team made up of the elite who can deploy anywhere in the world.
SEAL Team 6 members are known, but their operations are classified, so no one knows for sure who was on which mission. Kim Dozier is an AP journalist who covered the hunt for bin Laden and talked about their secrecy.
They were going to train and train and train and be ready if the president said, get on that plane and get to Pakistan. So they had two different sets of training in April at two different locations. They saw their families in between. Not one of them breathed a word to their families or to their other SEAL teammates at SEAL Team 6.
That's how the way the SEAL teams were designed. It's supposed to be all quiet. It's supposed to be for the operators to know. It was never supposed to be in the news or in the media. You don't want people to know how they come into a room or how they come in from a building or from the ground or how they board a ship. That was all a secret. Because when the enemy finds that out, they can defeat that. They can defeat that. There's 100 successes for every one that you hear about. There's 100 you don't hear about.
In Washington, D.C., in the Situation Room, President Obama and his top advisors were still going over the three plans that McRaven had set out for them. Former White House Homeland Security Advisor Francis Townsend reflected on how complicated the decision really was.
Whenever you're advising the president about a particular operation, it's what is the likelihood of success? How certain do you feel that your target's there and that you will have a good opportunity to successfully execute that mission? Versus what are the likely consequences or potential points of failure? And so in the Abbottabad case, what was the likelihood of civilian casualties? They knew women and children were in the compound. What was the likelihood they could be undetected by the Pakistani military getting in? What was the likelihood they were going to have to fight their way out? What was the likelihood of technical failure? And all of those things you've got to plan for, assess the risk against the potential gain.
So we learn from everything that goes wrong, and we create these SOPs, the standard operating procedures. We say those are written in blood, because if somebody gets hurt or killed, you know, it's doctrine now. We don't do it this way anymore, or now we do it this way.
Some of the senior advisors, people who had been working in the government for years, were thinking about past failures. Eric Schmidt, a journalist for the New York Times covering the operation, explained some of the cabinet's hesitations.
The National Security Council, these are his top advisors, people like Vice President Biden, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, Defense Secretary Bob Gates, the CIA Director Leon Panetta, and they're all giving their assessments to the president. Some are more skeptical about this than others. Gates is skeptical about sending in ground troops. He's worried about the effect of the raid. He's the one individual from this group who lived through Desert One as part of government then, as a member, as part of the CIA. Other intelligence officials, however, including Panetta, were much more bullish, much more optimistic that indeed their assessment that had been gathered over all these months was very close.
Though the SEAL team has participated in dozens of operations before, this one is especially dangerous and important. A successful execution can be a massive victory not only for the United States, but for the Obama administration. Or it could be a crushing failure on the home front.
He's obviously thinking very much history is on his mind. The raid that the United States tried to conduct with the hostages in Iran in 1980, the Desert One exercise that ended in failure.
Desert One, or Operation Eagle Claw, was a failed operation where the United States attempted to rescue hostages inside the Iran-American embassy. Instead, the mission was aborted, and the two helicopters collided on the way back. 8 American servicemen were killed. It was a blow for the Carter presidency and a setback for the Special Ops Unit as a whole. Cynthia Storer, one of the CIA analysts from Alex Station.
And, you know, Special Forces were slow to develop. It was very controversial all along. Then Desert One happened, and that set back the development of our Special Forces. But it really, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan really catapulted them to the sort of preeminent position, really.
Additionally, some of the cabinet in the room with Obama were still haunted by the Black Hawk Down incident in 1993, where Special Forces soldiers not only failed, but were killed and tortured. The most pressing case, though, was something that had happened only a few months earlier, an incident Obama had been through with a man contracted by the CIA named Raymond Allen Davis.
Earlier in 2011, there had been a CIA contractor by the name of Raymond Davis who had shot and killed a couple of Pakistanis. He'd been arrested. It had set off a great political turmoil both in Pakistan and with U.S.-Pakistani relations.
Mistakes had been made in the past. This was an important mission on multiple levels. To stack the odds in his favor, Obama ordered additional backup. A second SEAL team was set at the ready to take over if anything happened to the first, hovering in helicopters above the city just outside the Pakistani border. Here's Kim Dozier again.
The president listened to the plan and said, but what happens if there are fighters inside the compound? What happens if the Pakistani military responds with force? I want to be able to protect these guys and get them out.
And the fear that the president had was, if you send in commandos, what happens if they get pinned down under Pakistani fire? What happens if they are injured and perhaps captured and held as prisoners in this kind of attack? He did not want this. So what he did was he ordered the military commanders to have a beefed up option. Basically, they wanted the option to fight their way out if they had to. They didn't want to be pinned down. And so the military went back and devised some backup plans that had additional transport helicopters ready in the chance that there might be a problem.
As the president was still considering the options laid before him, the team had no choice but to start training. They started conducting rehearsal missions, perfecting the helicopter techniques, rope drops, and nuances of timing. The team had also been running dozens of nightly raids next door in Afghanistan, so they had been unintentionally honing the skills they would need to raid the compound.
Between Iraq and Afghanistan, the guys have been deploying constantly back and forth to both countries. They're very battle-hardened. They have more combat experience now than any unit in the world, and they've been fighting more than we've ever fought as a country. I mean, so when it came time to get in the op for bin Laden, I mean, they were more than ready.
The team were also sent to prepare domestically in North Carolina in the Nevada desert. An exact replica of the compound was built, as close to the actual dimensions as they had information on, allowing them to train for every potential scenario. Ryan Zinke and Don Mann remember.
You could have landmines, or the whole building could be a trap. And the moment you get in the compound, you know, 4,000 pounds of explosives gets detonated. You know, that's enough to kill the entire force.
But the guys are so trained that they know that they have a bunch of contingencies that they have to prepare for, and that plans don't always go according to plan. We have a saying, you know, plan your dive, then dive your plan. But it's rare an op ever goes like it's planned. There's always something that comes up without expecting it. But the guys are ready for that type of thing.
At the White House, Eric Schmidt explains, the advisors were busy preparing every possible scenario.
So within the White House itself, John Brennan, the president's counterterrorism advisor, Dennis McDonough, one of the top national security aides, the president, and others were actually devising something they called the playbook. It was a three-ring binder about 2 inches thick, and it was all the various contingencies of what could go right, what could go wrong, things in the middle. What would happen, for instance, if this Navy SEAL team, when it got in on the ground, was engaged by Pakistani soldiers or police? What would you do then? There were contingencies for what happened if you actually took bin Laden alive. There were lawyers standing by. There were doctors standing by in Afghanistan to administer him if he was wounded but wasn't dead. What would you do then? Where would you place him? Would you put him on a prison in Afghanistan? Would you take him to a ship?
The White House went over the intel with the military. To their knowledge, the layout of the compound was this. There were high walls securing the compound, as high as 18 feet, and behind that were at least two buildings. The smaller building housed the Al-Qaeda courier, known by the alias Al-Kuwaiti, and his family. In the main building was Al-Kuwaiti's brother, along with a mystery man, the one they called the Pacer, or the Tall Man, who seemed to never leave the compound. With this information, the SEALs decided they would have to split into two groups. One group would land in the courtyard and secure the perimeter, while the other would swing onto the roof directly from the helicopter, taking the residents by surprise. As the SEALs prepared, the president called in more experts to get fresh eyes on the mission. This is a typical CIA exercise called red teaming, giving a contradictory, objective assessment of the information. The red team were given everything that had been gathered on the case to decide. Was there really enough information to follow through? After reviewing the material, the red team concluded that the chances of bin Laden being in the compound were 50-50. And as CIA analyst Philip Mudd explains, the odds were as high as they were going
to
get.
To get to 50% certainty on the hunt for bin Laden, when I looked at it, I was sitting there replaying all the thoughts in my mind of the times that we wanted to get him, of the successes, the failures, 10 years of participation in this hunt. To get to 50-50 in itself, I thought was significant. That might seem low odds for Vegas. For me as an intelligence professional, that's pretty good odds.
The problems with those odds, of course, are first, there's leaks in this town. So if you want to get up to 60, you run the risk of leaks. And second, the risk that he moves. So if you want to get up to 60 again, and he moves, all of a sudden you're back down and you say, is he going to use the same courier network? So you've got to bank on saying, we're only going to have one shot and this is it.
There wasn't a lot of objective evidence. There were no photographs, no recordings, only conjecture based on observation. In the final White House meeting, journalist Kim Dozier reported that the participants went around the table to state their final dissent or remarks before the decision was made.
Secretary of State Clinton, she was convinced that this was the right call to make, even though she lined up all of her doubts before saying, you know, we could be very wrong. We could end up with a bad relationship with Pakistan for a decade to come, but this is the right call to go in.
And of course, it got to be a joke as they went around because they each echo each other as if to kind of shield them from the ultimate responsibility of having to make this decision, knowing, of course, the commander-in-chief will be the one who decides whether to go or not.
I think most of us would have said the risk here is huge. And the best we could do is to say, boss, I'm going to have to ask you to take a huge risk. That said, I think I would have said, I'm not sure it's going to get any better. And now it's on your back.
In the end, the ultimate decision was in the hands of the commander-in-chief. Does he risk the lives of American troops with so much still unknown? Ideally, there would be more time to assess and reassess the intel. But delay carried its own risk.
What happens if you wait so long to have it be perfect that you lose the opportunity? I mean, it's understandable that there were members of President Obama's cabinet who were reluctant to sort of try to encourage the president to authorize the raid, understanding all those risks. But when you think, you know, clearly in the end, the president's judgment was if there's a credible opportunity and they knew they had that to get bin Laden, it was worth those risks. Presidents, you know, you don't get certainty. You just don't in this business. And so if you're unwilling to take any risk at all, being president of the United States is not the job for you.
The next morning, President Obama called his top advisors. He'd made up his mind.
It was the best information they were going to have, that they were going to get. This was bin Laden, and this was the opportunity to strike, the opportunity they'd been looking for years, and the risks were worth it.
Operation Neptune's Spear was a go, called so because of the Navy's sigil of Neptune's trident. The raid was planned for the following day, Saturday, April 30th. As the SEALs prepared themselves, it was business as usual in the White House. The president continued with his planned commitments, which included the White House Correspondents' Dinner, the annual gathering of the journalists and media members who cover the White House and presidency. Traditionally, the president attends, and Obama had a tradition of roasting both himself and the media. It was a weird tonal shift.
It is wonderful to be here at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. As some of you heard, the state of Hawaii released my official long-form birth certificate. Tonight, for the first time, I am releasing my official birth video. I want to make clear to the Fox News table, that was a joke.
This is an annual event here in Washington where the president shows up in a black tie. He's usually subject, you know, he's expected to give a funny speech.
Well, the White House advisors really debated, do we pretend that the president is sick so that he doesn't go to the White House Correspondents' Dinner? Because do we want him making jokes from the podium, which is the point of that particular dinner, just as the Raiders are hitting the compound? What if the helicopters go down? What if you have another Black Hawk Down situation where you lose a whole team?
Yes, I think it is fair to say that when it comes to my presidency, the honeymoon is over. For example, some people now suggest that I'm too professorial, and I'd like to address that head on by assigning all of you some reading that will help you draw your own conclusions.
At the last minute, cloudy weather delayed the mission, and the team had to wait another day to carry out the plan. So on May 1st at 11 p.m. in Jalalabad, Afghanistan, two Black Hawk helicopters took off from a U.S. airbase. Each were carrying 12 members of Navy SEAL Team 6. The operation to get Osama bin Laden was finally underway. Don Mann described what the mood must have been like on that moonless night.
Boy, this is a little hairy here. Okay, we are flying in packs, and yet this is a go. This is definitely a go. And then it gets more excitement in the air, and everybody starts getting a lot more serious. Board the helos, we're definitely going now. We're going in. It's going in at night. And now you're flying in. You don't know what's going to happen in the while you're in the air in those helos. You know, helos get shot down all the time.
The SEAL team were flying in brand-new, state-of-the-art stealth helicopters, specifically designed for the mission. On the tense flight to Abbottabad, the troops went through last-minute preparations, going over the plans, divvying up the tasks, sorting through all the what-if scenarios.
We have very detailed patrol leader's order. It's time you're going in, time you're coming out, what gear you're going to take, who's going to be sitting where in the helos. The air is so, so thick. People are saying last-minute prayers and thinking about the families and making sure the weapons are loaded, doing press checks, making sure there's a round in the chamber, making sure all the gear is secured, going over last-minute notes with the buddies, thinking of all the details.
President Obama had ultimately determined that bringing the Pakistanis in on the plan could mean losing the one chance in almost a decade to get Osama bin Laden. But keeping the Pakistanis in the dark would make this raid even more risky. Philip Mudd.
This isn't just going against a walled compound in Afghanistan. It's not just going against a tiny village in the tribal areas of Pakistan, because there you're going in there typically with the cooperation of local security services, the Pakistanis. This is crossing a border, crossing a large territory of Pakistan, a sovereign country, without the knowledge of local security services, with the prospect that local police might get onto you and start shooting you in Abbottabad. The risk factors here were incredible.
Along with the 24 soldiers were a translator who could speak Pashto and a dog named Cairo, a member of the K-9 unit. The unnamed translator would be a buffer between the citizens around the compound and the people inside, and to draw onlookers away from the scene if something went awry. And the dog?
If anti-personnel and sniffing things out. I mean, they could search him to go, you know, go search something for smell, looking for somebody.
Outside the compound, he was supposed to help look for squirters, anyone who might try to flee the compound and get away towards the hills in the back. He was also supposed to used inside the compound to look for secret passageways, secret compartments, if there were any. There didn't turn out to be any. His main role in the end was to stand with the dog handler and the CIA operative who was on the mission and to ward people away who approached, saying, you know, what's the noise inside? There's an operation going inside. Nothing to worry about. Go back to your homes.
The operation took the precautions that Obama had ordered earlier. Soon after the Blackhawks departed, four MH-47 Chinooks launched toward Jalalabad carrying backup hovering nearby. And the operation's pilots were the Night Stalkers, members of the Army's elite 160th Special Aviation Regiment. John Magnus has years of experience flying into enemy territory.
We're called night stalkers for a reason. We tend to like to fly at night to give us the cover of darkness.
Flying in the dark is a lot different than flying in the day. And sound acts differently. Light obviously acts differently. And so the whole mission is planned to hit the target from an unexpected direction and an unexpected time.
Kim Dozier reported that the Black Hawk helicopters had been covered with radar-deflecting paint, and the rotors had been silenced to minimize attention. With technology and skill on their side, they managed to cross the border into Pakistan undetected. But just as they were hovering above the compound, one of the pilots ran into unexpected trouble.
The air was hotter than anyone had expected. And what they think happened is that the helicopter lost control because the air was thinner and the helicopter therefore was heavier and started falling a little bit through space, sliding greasily back and forth.
The helicopter went down outside the compound, throwing the SEALs inside to the ground. Any element of surprise was lost.
In the original plan, they were going to fast rope down into the outer courtyard. It would have taken 2 minutes to land these guys and maybe 10 minutes in all to storm both buildings.
The town's awake. And so they're thinking any minute now we can be run down with, you know, a lot of enemy forces coming at us.
The backup in the Chinooks waited with bated breath. Drones flying over the compound streamed the disaster as it unfolded, back to Vice Admiral McRaven in Jalalabad, to the CIA headquarters in Langley, and to the Situation Room in the White House.
What was going on was in an adjacent room, there was actually a military assistant who was actually watching the feed from the CIA, and a couple of the people from the other room had walked in there. And we're watching this, and suddenly Obama comes in. He says, "I want to watch this too." So if you see the photograph, when they're all jammed in a very small kind of adjacent room, kind of listening, watching the feed that they're getting from the drones.
All they could see is the helicopter going down and then crashing, and wondering, "Have we just lost the mission?" Your heart's in your throat. You don't know at any moment if the Pakistanis are going to come rushing in. You don't know if you're going to hear that the whole mission has been lost. So that famous moment when the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, has her mouth open in what looks like a scream, that was about the moment, according to the president, that the helicopter went down. An extremely tense moment until they heard from McRaven, "No, the guys are out, the guys are good. And we're prepared for this. We're modifying the plan."
Back in Pakistan, the second Black Hawk helicopter scrapped the plan to hover over the compound and rope down. They landed quickly in an open field to join the other SEALs. There was no time to stop and react. The SEALs immediately activated Plan B, storm the compound from the ground.
If failure is not an option, we have to have a way to accomplish the mission.
The first thing the guys have to do is duck the heads, run under the blades, get a full head count, make sure everybody's there. Once you're at the door's got to be breached. As soon as the door's breached, people in, left, right, left, right, left, right, and then you make movement.
The translator held off the curious onlookers, explaining that a security operation was going on. Meanwhile, using C4, the SEALs blasted through two layers of doors and fences and made it into the courtyard. The next step was to get to the main building where they thought Bin Laden was hiding, but they still had no knowledge of who else might be in the compound or how many of those people were armed. There was also the additional caveat of the known children inside the compound.
Every stairwell, there were these knots of children who were standing, cowering, hiding, trying to avoid getting caught. Trying to avoid getting hit and not knowing what to do or where to run.
Moving, going through danger areas, clearing rooms, moving, checking stairways.
That meant in that time, fighting their way room to room, they had to shoot anyone who got in their way, but also avoid shooting all the women and children that they knew from those months of observation were there. Night vision goggles, and with the knowledge that they didn't know how they were going to get the heck out of there when this was over, because one of their choppers was down.
With no time to hesitate, the SEALs split into two teams. One group slowly cleared the courtyard. The other blasted down the door and ran inside the guest house. Immediately, someone opened fire. They shot back and hit a young man in the chest. He matched the description of bin Laden's son, Khalid. Without stopping, the SEALs moved to clear the next building, finding that some of the doorways were blocked.
They get a closed door. They know to get security on it. People blast through the door.
After clearing the smaller building and bombing their way through doors, they've eliminated all the main threats inside. Kuwaiti, his brother, Abrar, and Khalid. All that was left was bin Laden himself. Now inside the main building, the team advanced up the stairs leading to the top floor.
They approach the top hallway. They've gotten through the final landing, and they're running to the top, and Osama bin Laden pokes his head around the doorway, down the hallway. One of the first SEALs in the line sees him, because they're running in single file, and he sees him, knows that's bin Laden. Bin Laden turns around, runs back down the hallway, and dashes into his bedroom. Running away like that sealed his fate. Had he surrendered right there, their orders were, okay, he's surrendering, flexi-cuff him, let's take him away for interrogation. Instead, by running back to the bedroom, they had to presume that he was running back there for a weapon. So they followed. 1, 2, 3 SEALs down the hallway. First SEAL goes through the bedroom doorway. There's bin Laden and two women, including one of his wives, in front of him. The women rushed the SEAL. He had to assume that they might be wearing suicide vests. It was a tactic that had been used before against other raiders in other raids. So he grabs them, throws them to the side. The SEAL behind him sees bin Laden, brings up his weapon, 2 shots. One to the head, 1 to the chest. It's done.
It was over in less than 20 minutes. The team sent the operational signal for sighting their target, Geronimo.
One of the 3 SEALs said into his mouthpiece, Geronimo. That signaled to Admiral McCraven, they've got bin Laden. They've secured him. Didn't mean he was dead. So McCraven relayed that to the White House. And then he says to his guys, EKIA, meaning enemy killed in action. And he got back, Geronimo, EKIA, meaning they'd secured bin Laden and he was dead. In the Situation Room, it was, we got him. We think. Wait, maybe? We hope. Admiral McCraven was cautioning them, look, we've got to get him back. We aren't 100% certain. And our guys are still on the ground. Our guys are still under threat. We still have to get them out of there, and we've got 1 chopper down. So this isn't done yet. So that's why in the Situation Room, there was this kind of tense, they wanted to cheer, but they couldn't cheer yet.
The room they were standing in was a mess of bullets, bodies, and blood. But they couldn't quite leave yet. The SEALs still had to confirm they had the right man. They couldn't be sure it was an impersonator, and because of the nature of his wounds, his identity was unclear. They collected DNA samples.
With that, the SEALs started evidence collection, taking photographs of bin Laden's face and sending those back so that 2 waiting teams in the CIA who were facial recognition experts could compare those photos against photos of bin Laden on file, measuring the length of the nose, the length of the jaw, things like that, to try to ascertain, is this really the right guy? He could have had a lookalike. They also took 2 DNA samples that would be compared with the database of bin Laden's family that was on file at Langley.
Bin Laden had been running al-Qaeda from the compound, meaning that it was potentially full of plans and intel. The evidence he left behind could possibly be used to prevent future attacks.
It took them 19 minutes to get to bin Laden, and then in the rest of the time, they had some important goals. Site exploitation was key. That means they were going from room to room looking for computers, cell phones, documents, anything that might tell them what bin Laden had been doing there for the past 6 years, and anything that might lead them to other parts of the network. They were expecting to find a couple of thumb drives, some disks, maybe a computer or 2. What they got instead was what they're calling a treasure trove on Al-Qaeda. 5 computers and 10 hard drives and more than 100 different forms of media, from thumb drives to disks, that basically mapped out bin Laden's communications with his network for the previous 6 years. This was a gold mine, and it's led to a number of targets since then.
But every minute they spent gathering material put the teams at greater risk. While the translator is mostly keeping curious residents at bay, it was only a matter of time before they started to believe they're under attack from American forces. One of the backup Chinook helicopters waiting by the border made its way to the compound to assist in the evacuation, with bin Laden's body on board. Before taking off, they had to take care of the crashed helicopter. It was full of classified design and technology. The government didn't want it to fall into the wrong hands.
We didn't want that technology out. We're always developing. The SEALs have the state-of-the-art equipment. And every year and every generation, the helicopters get a little faster, a little lighter, a little harder to detect. And it's just a lot of technology that we didn't like having to give up. But
they had to blow up the stealth helicopter. They couldn't leave it for the Pakistani army to dismantle and sell technology from. So they had to wire that up. They also had to secure all the women and children and keep them away from the helicopter so that they weren't injured in the explosion.
In the early morning hours, the SEAL team made it back to Jalalabad. There, Osama bin Laden's body was positively identified. Hours later, he was taken to the aircraft carrier USS Carl Vinson and given a burial at sea.
They prepared his body for Islamic burial, and the next morning, tipped him, wrapped in a shroud, into the sea. The important thing for U.S. officials was a burial at sea meant no tomb for followers to come worship and be inspired by bin Laden to future acts of violence against the U.S.
The White House team was ready to announce the news to the world. America's number one most wanted terrorist is dead.
When the helicopters got back over the border into Afghanistan and it dawned on the people inside the Situation Room and the top CIA officials at Langley watching from their viewing station that they've done it. Looks like we've got bin Laden and all the SEALs and all the team supporting them safely out. That's when people quietly started popping the champagne bottles. And the first cheers went up.
A few days later, when President Obama went to congratulate the SEALs, the question of who shot Osama bin Laden was raised. The collective answer, "We all did, sir." The team then handed the president an American flag with an inscription saying, "Operation Neptune Spear, May 1st, 2011. For God and Country, Geronimo."
Good evening. Tonight, I can report to the American people and to the world that the United States has conducted an operation that killed Osama bin Laden, the leader of Al-Qaeda, and a terrorist who's responsible for the murder of thousands of innocent men, women, and children. It was nearly 10 years ago that a bright September day was darkened by the worst attack on the American people in our history. The images of 9/11 are seared into our national memory.
Since the attack, two of the Navy SEALs on the mission, Matt Bissonnette and Robert J. O'Neill, controversially broke the tradition of silence and came forward to claim they took part in the bin Laden assassination. However, we will probably never know for sure who took the fatal shot. One thing is for sure, the successful mission, after two presidents before him failed, was a shining triumph for the Obama administration. And more importantly, it helped bring closure to the families of those who died in the attacks, on the towers, in the embassies.
As these guys were flying towards the target, and they knew what the target was, they were thinking about 9/11. I have heard that from several people who know the people who are on the raid. That some of the guys said things like, you know, there are 3,000 souls on this helicopter. There are 3,000 souls with us as we storm the hallway on the final approach to bin Laden. They do think about the wider cause, why they're there. They also think about all of their teammates they lost along the way.
On the next episode, we'll take a trip to Sierra Leone during the Civil War of 2000. How did British soldiers get caught in the middle of this? And how did they escape the West Side Boys?
They were at continuing high risk of harm. The worst case scenario is that they would be killed at the outset, as a number of missionaries had been previously. So that was the good news. The bad news in this situation is the unpredictability and the volatility of the situation and the individuals concerned. So in the blink of an eye, you can move from a situation where you have stable, well-treated hostages to them being killed.
That's next time on Covert. Covert is an Audio Boom and World Media Rights co-production, hosted by me, Jamie Rennell. It is produced by Audio Boom's Ben Hosley and Rachel Jacobs, and by Pascal Hughes for World Media Rights. We had editing help by David Markowitz, with additional production from World Media Rights by Gerald Zabengwa and Damian Thorpe. David McNabb is the series creative director, and the executive producers for Audio Boom are Brendan Regan and Stuart Last.